Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 9th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on Arizona schools and books, and then we'll move on to another article on wildfires. This feature article is entitled A Bookish Debate with the subtitle, Complaint Prompts Arizona School District to Change How Novels Are Chosen. This is by Madeline Parrish. Matthew Boy began the final quarter of the 2023-24 school year by assigning an individual reading project, just as he had for the previous 4 years. Students in his 11th grade English class at Williams Field High School in Gilbert could choose from 5 books, The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky, It's Kind of a Funny Story by Ned Vizzini, 19 Minutes by Jodi Picoult, and Paper Towns by John Green. Permission slips with summaries of the books went home to families and students, and their guardians were allowed to suggest an alternate title. Nearly all of Boy's 140 students returned the permission slip with a book selected. But the grandparents of one student took issue with the list. Bob Parrish brought his concerns to the Higley Unified School District's elected leaders. In May, during the public comment portion of a governing board meeting, he read a passage from 19 Minutes that described a sexual act between two characters. Introducing this into our schools only exacerbates the moral decline of our youth, Parrish said. Parrish's granddaughter remained in the class and chose an alternate novel. She really liked him as a teacher, Kelly Parrish, Bob's wife, said of Boy. But the Parrishes complained to district administrators and ultimately to the Arizona State Board of Education about the 5 books suggested for the assignment. It really infuriated us. Let's save a little innocence here, Kelly Parrish said. They're thinking that all the kids have deviant minds. Well, they don't, and it's just not right. Higley Unified placed Boy on paid leave for 7 school days, he said. The district investigated but found no wrongdoing. Parents of the 12 students in Boy's class who chose 19 minutes were called multiple times to make sure they still gave permission for their child to read the book, which they all did, Boy said. 19 Minutes, about a school shooting, was the book most commonly banned from U.S. public schools during the 2023-24 school year, according to the nonprofit PEN America. Higley Unified spokesperson Jessica Batista said in a statement that the district followed all district and state policies and procedures regarding the complaint against Boy, and its inquiry resulted in no findings. Boy did not find out the State Board of Education had cleared him in its investigation until the fall, he said. During the May board meeting, Bob Parrish acknowledged that Boy's assignment had required a guardian signature, but he said it had no content warning for any of the novels. If there was a warning stating the books contained sexually explicit material, obscenities, drug and alcohol use, sexual acts, masturbation, suicide, abortion, and police racism and brutality, those are all the reviews from the internet on these 5 books, I believe parents would have exercised more caution and actually reviewed the books before signing a permission slip, Bob Parrish said. He asked the district to standardize the parental consent form requiring specific details regarding all objectionable content. Over the summer, Higley Unified decided to do just that. Higley Unified has long had a list of novels approved for teacher use. Before this school year, when a teacher wanted to assign a novel that was not on the list, they would obtain parental permission. Now, teachers must stick to the approved novel list. That means that 2 of the 5 books on Boy's list, 19 Minutes and The Perks of Being a Wallflower, can no longer be assigned. For novels on the approved list with sensitive content, sexually explicit content, violence, drug or alcohol use, sensitive content to race and ethnicity, offensive language, or content related to mental health or suicide, the district created a more formalized and thorough permission slip. The slips tell parents what sensitive content the book includes. Students whose guardian chooses not to permit their child to read a suggested novel are given alternate assignments. Previously, the content of permission slips was determined by individual teachers and schools. Because of violence, permission slips are now required for books like Lord of the Flies by William Golding and Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. Animal Farm by George Orwell needs a permission slip because of violence and sensitive content to race and ethnicity. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which is read in ninth grade, gets a slip for sexually explicit content and violence. Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, assigned to seniors, needs a slip because of sexually explicit content, sensitive content to race and ethnicity, and violence. Most novels assigned in advanced placement classes, college-level courses that students can take to obtain college credit with an end-of-year exam offered by the nonprofit College Board, require permission slips. Now, if a teacher wants to introduce a novel into their class that is not already on the approved list, the book must go through a new committee review process. Teachers must plan ahead. The process takes a full school year. The committee, which was formed at the beginning of the school year, identifies sensitive topics in each novel while weighing them against the literary merit of the book. Committee members note how prevalent each of the permission slip's sensitive content areas is in each book. Mary Davis, Higley Unified's Director of Professional Development and the leader of the Novel Review Committee, likened it to a rating system. Arizona law requires parental permission for student exposure to sexually explicit material at school. The remaining sensitive areas identified by the district are an effort to be more transparent with parents, Davis said. For the sensitive content to race and ethnicity, that's just been something that parents have raised concerns about because they just want to know, especially if it has to do with slavery or civil rights, just so that they can start to have those conversations at home and frame it within their family context, she said. Board member Anna Van Hoek asked during a July board meeting if sexuality could be included as one of the areas noted on the permission slip, but the district's lawyer advised against it. After the committee votes to approve books suggested by teachers, the public has 60 days to review them and provide feedback before the governing board decides whether to approve them for classroom use. Books go through committee to the public and then to the school board. More than 90 people applied over the summer to serve on the Novel Review Committee. It was an overwhelming response, which was really exciting, Davis said, and the district narrowed the pool to 28 members with a random draw. Half of the committee is made up of district staff, while the other half is made up of parents and community members. This school year, the committee reviewed 17 books requested by teachers. All were approved, and the committee decided permission slips should be required for about half. Over three meetings, committee members noted instances of profanity, alcohol use, smoking, murder, racial discrimination, abuse, and anything else they anticipated might raise concerns among parents. For The Devil's Highway by Luis Alberto Urrea, requested for an advanced placement 11th grade class, the committee wrote that there were descriptions of medically accurate death in the desert, brief allusions to instances of Border Patrol groping and raping women, and critiques of Border Patrol, but does also show the other side of that as well. For They Called Us Enemy by George Takei, which was requested for ninth grade students, the committee noted that the book mentioned war, bombing, and protests, and was critical of the American government during World War II and their involvement in Japanese internment camps. Committee members noted a teenage pregnancy and instances of stalking and children running away in Clap When You Land by Elizabeth Acevedo, An Adulterous Relationship in Big Fish by Daniel Wallace, Colonialism, Racism, and Discussions of Mental Health and Suicide in Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, An Inference of Premarital Sexual Relations in The Beantown Girls by Jane Healy, The Creation of a New Religion in Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler. They checked passages against the Arizona statute requiring parental consent for student exposure to sexually explicit materials. Those concerns will be presented to the governing board before its members vote on the novels. Although the novel review group resulted from concerns about sensitive content, much of the discussion and committee meetings centered on the book's positive elements and ultimately why they were being recommended for approval. Committee members discussed book's potential for engaging students, their representations of unique perspectives, the valuable lessons they offered, and their literary qualities, focusing on elements like imagery, symbolism, vocabulary, and character development. The governing board will be presented with those positives too. Just because it has violence or any of those sensitive content areas in there doesn't warrant the book will be tossed out, Davis said. It just means that we're looking at what is in that novel that has that educational value to meet academic standards. After the public review period, this school year's batch of books is set to go before the board for final approval in May. Will process discourage use of potentially controversial novels? Higley Unified's novel review process was modeled off similar existing processes in nearby school districts, including Scottsdale Unified and Paradise Valley Unified. It also mirrors a trend nationwide. There has been increasing regulation from state boards of education, state legislatures, and local school boards that resemble Higley Unified's new policy around books, said Deborah Caldwell Stone, the director of the American Library Association Office for Intellectual Freedom. These regulations, Caldwell Stone said, treat books as items that can cause harm. Caldwell Stone said she thought Higley Unified's process would stigmatize certain topics and likely dissuade teachers from recommending any literature that might touch on a theme that a parent might find controversial or sensitive. That could limit the availability of challenging, enriching literature for students, she said. It puts the onus on the district to flag anything that might trip up a parent's sensitivities, rather than relying on the parent to take responsibility for guiding their children's reading, Caldwell Stone said. Mindy Brocker, a parent in the district, called the process an unnecessary bowing to screeching pressure from a very noisy minority during a July board meeting. We're limiting our students' intellectual growth and their ability to engage with complex and sometimes uncomfortable topics that are part of our shared human experience, Brocker said, adding that the committee was deceptive because the governing board would have the final say on the books. For Kelly Parrish, the new permission slips are better, but insufficient. Permission slip signatures can be forged by students, she said, or signed quickly by parents who skim them over. They need to do a better job of contacting parents and ensuring they are truly aware of what is in the book, she said. She said that she thought the district was trying to normalize deviant behavior. You don't have to know everything, Kelly Parrish said. It's just bothersome that they can't get past just having better books that don't have all the explicit material to get points across. She also wished there was more parent representation on the novel review committee. I don't trust it, she said. She didn't apply to be on the committee, though she said she might in the future. Boy, who now works in another school district in Maricopa County, a move he had been planning before the complaints against him in May, said he had chosen the five novels because they had young adult protagonists who were about the age of his students, 16 and 17. Many of his students have found the assignment impactful, he said. One former student, boy said, decided to join a new club senior year after reading The Perks of Being a Wallflower, a central theme of which is to participate in life, not just watch. It was intentional that each of the five books dealt with sensitive topics, Boy said, because it's very real. Boy said he thought the new process would allow parents to be informed and protect teachers from the situation he experienced. But he also described it as a little heavy-handed. I understand that there's a section of parents who are highly involved and that they very much want what's best for their kid. And they want to protect their kids from harms of the world, Boy said. I don't blame them for that by any means. That said, I don't think novels are the source of harms in this world, he said. I think novels, ones worth reading, show characters who we should be able to relate to overcoming these things, dealing with these things, processing these things, becoming stronger individuals as a result. And I think by not allowing students who are of the appropriate age to read novels like that, I think we're denying them seeing a very human aspect that we all are related and connected. Intimidation tactics. Gilbert Police investigate teachers' novel assignment. The first reading assignment of the 2024-25 school year in Brittany O'Neill's Multicultural Literature course, an honors class for seniors that offered Chandler Gilbert Community College credit, was Homegoing by Yah Jesse. Homegoing was on the approved novel list, and following the procedures that had been adopted over the summer, O'Neill sent permission slips home, telling parents that the book contains sexually explicit content, violence, drug and alcohol use, and sensitive content about race and ethnicity. The book contains descriptions of sexual violence, including rape, and other explicit sexual acts as related to the African slave trade, the permission slip stated. The novel addresses complex themes such as racism, trauma, addiction, and physical violence. While these elements contribute to the historical and emotional depth of the story, they may be disturbing or inappropriate for some readers. An alternate text was offered for students whose parents chose not to let their child read the book. But by the end of the first week of school, a parent had accused O'Neill of grooming and disseminating child pornography because of the Homegoing assignment, O'Neill said. The parent was concerned about a sexual assault scene in the book, she said. By the end of the second week of school, this parent had called other parents of students in my class, attempted to have the police open an investigation against me, and spread lies about my course in an attempt to irrevocably damage my reputation, not only as an educator, but as a human being, O'Neill said during the public comment portion of a board meeting in August. In September, the Gilbert Police Department began investigating O'Neill on suspicion of committing two crimes by assigning Homegoing to her 12th grade students, furnishing harmful items to minors, and the production, publication, sale, possession, and presentation of obscene items, both felonies. O'Neill said she felt like intimidation tactics were being employed. During the investigation, a detective from the Gilbert Police Department's Special Victims Unit showed up at Williamsfield High School twice while she was teaching, she said. Gilbert Police concluded its investigation after finding there was insufficient probable cause to pursue criminal charges against O'Neill, according to the department. During an August board meeting, Ashton Churchill, a student in the Honors Multicultural Literature class, spoke in support of O'Neill. We in this class are seniors in high school. Many of us are nearly legal adults, Churchill said. We will soon be voting in elections, moving away from our parents, entering the full-time workforce, and overall diving into the complexities of real-world living. It is time to stop running from such genuine and pertinent topics such as those found in our assigned academic reading. Dominic D'Ambrosio, another student in the class, said during the meeting that when he and his classmates signed up for the Honors Multicultural Literature class, they expected discussion not to be simple or easy. He spoke about the perks of being a wallflower, too, saying that although he could understand that parents are upset with the sensitive natures the book explores, it connects us with teens, giving us something to relate to, as well as something to factor into our lives to further us. O'Neill said the accusations against her were painful. "It's caused immense anxiety in my life," she said. "Early on, I didn't really want to go out in my community because I didn't know who would recognize me, what had they heard about me, and what did they assume about me." O'Neill is now on the district's novel review committee, which she thinks is valuable for both educators who can hear parents' concerns and for parents who can use it to understand better how educators select reading materials. She said she thinks the committee protects educators legally and professionally, though not necessarily from the kinds of comments she received this year. O'Neill fears, however, that teachers might choose not to teach books that require permission slips and opt instead for those that don't include any of the sensitive content areas. "That could greatly undermine the level of rigor that we can offer in literature," she said. "It could also undermine student engagement," she said, "by limiting the number of contemporary novels, which can be easier for them to relate to, offered to them." For O'Neill, it's worth it to go through the extra process of the permission slip paperwork to teach the novels that I know are best for my class, she said. But other educators might not be willing to put themselves in the hot seat by teaching a book with those sensitive content areas. "We know there will be a target on our back if we do," she said. "I worry that if we trend back to only teaching books that have nothing in them, it's going to limit the depth of analysis that we can do, which only limits our students' intelligence and their success later on in life," O'Neill said. And that article was entitled "A Bookish Debate," and that was by Madeline Parrish. Now, in Valley and State News, we have an article on wildfires entitled "How Phoenix is Preparing for a Catastrophic Wildfire." This is by Taylor Seeley. Phoenix's water, fire, and emergency management leaders aim to dispel concerns over whether a catastrophic urban wildfire could ignite and overwhelm city response systems like the one that devastated vast swaths of Southern California earlier this year. The meeting, called by Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, included Water Resources Director Troy Hayes, Phoenix Fire Chief Tim Kreese, and Emergency Management Director Brian Lee. After the January 7th fire broke out in the Palisades, razing communities and devastating those left in its wake, elected leaders in Phoenix started asking questions about whether the same could happen here and how prepared the city was to respond, Phoenix Communications Director Dan Wilson said. Hayes, Kreese, and Lee gave a 25-minute presentation laying out their strategies to mitigate risk, which included prevention, water infrastructure redundancies, and emergency preparedness. Highlights include: the fire department beefs up responses to fires in at-risk zones during spring and monsoon seasons. The Water Resources Department said its water plants and reservoirs have ample capacity to handle increased water demands during emergency situations and can order significant amounts of extra water and supply it for firefighting within 6 hours. The Emergency Management Office, which would be responsible for coordinating a response among local, state, and federal officials, said it conducts regular exercise to test their preparedness. Here's what to know. Where are the local risks and how does Phoenix Fire prepare? The highest risk in Phoenix is springtime before the monsoon season, Kreese said. The at-risk zones are in the northern and southern parts of the city where undeveloped desert landscape stretches, plus areas near Camelback Mountain. Kreese said when temperatures exceed 105 degrees and the humidity is below 15%, the fire risk goes up significantly. It's further exacerbated by high winds, he said. The fire chief said the department had various partnerships to manage landscape and brush, including controlled burns, to mitigate risk. The department also partners with the city's Water Services Department, state and federal air support, and Phoenix Police air support during active firefighting. When weather conditions are ripe for fire risk, Kreese said the department activates the Wildland Urban Interface Program. That means if someone calls 911 from an at-risk zone and reports a grass, brush, or wildfire, the department sends 5 engines, multiple brush trucks, and tenders and commanders. Previously, the department would have sent 1 engine and brush truck. Sending a bunch of resources early and stopping the fires early is a whole lot better than having to send hundreds and deal with a fire that could be very destructive in our community, Kreese said. Kreese said the department also uses drones with thermal detection to ensure fires are put out. The threat of wildfires will continue to evolve, Kreese said, making the importance of firefighter training and preparing increasingly important. He said the department, as is already challenged with long response times and resource issues, and having a significant wildfire is going to stress our system. Benefiting Phoenix, he noted, was the automatic aid system, which essentially turns all municipal fire departments in the valley into one massive regional department for the community. That's different from other states, where fire departments often have to ask others for help, Kreese said. Phoenix's automatic system is possible because all Valley firefighters go to the same regional academy and learn the same things, he said. Does Phoenix have enough water to fight a catastrophic fire? Phoenix's 5 water plants that treat water used to fight fires can process up to 610 million gallons per day. The city's water users consume somewhere around 400 million gallons of water on the hottest summer days, leaving 200 million gallons left over to fight fires, Hayes explained. The Pallet fires in June 2023 at 35th Avenue and Lower Buckeye Road that drew 100 firefighters from 4 cities demanded 2 million gallons of water over a couple of days by comparison, Hayes said. But fighting fires requires more than just water supply and manpower. Water storage tanks, pipes, fire, and hydrants play a critical role. Pressure zones and pump stations are also integral to moving water between high and low elevations. Hayes said Phoenix's water system has a series of redundancies. In other words, if something should fall through in one location, there are other methods to push water where it needs to be. Phoenix has 57 reservoirs, 13 major pressure zones, and 109 booster pump stations, Hayes said. The city also has 57,000 fire hydrants, which are assessed annually. Hayes acknowledged the city in 2022 had a backlog of broken fire hydrants, but said that had since been fixed. On average, 99% of the hydrants are operational, leaving roughly 570 unusable on any given day. Information about the out-of-service hydrants is relayed to the fire department through a GIS system, he said. Hayes told the Republic the broken hydrants were spread across the city and not clustered in any one area. The sheer number of hydrants available mean firefighters have access to water everywhere in the city, he said. As another backstop to ensure water availability, the department sends an operational specialist to the fire department's Incident Command Center to help the department determine how to get more water to an area in need during emergencies. Does the city have a plan for an emergency? During a fire emergency, Phoenix's Emergency Management Director would activate the Emergency Operations Center and Joint Information Center, then alert Maricopa County's Department of Emergency Management, Lee said. His office would be responsible for connecting the city departments with county, state, and federal resources to coordinate an effective and efficient response to fire emergencies. That could include coordination with utilities such as SRP or APS. The office would handle traffic management, facilitating evacuations, establishing shelters, and family reunification assistance centers. Its role would also be to provide communication internally and externally to the public, Lee said. Communication would entail instructions to shelter in place, he said. Lee said a top priority, learned from watching the Palisades fire unfold, would be unified messaging. That has to be in place so that we're sending the right information to the right people at the right time, Lee said. He noted the city would leverage social media, emergency phone alerts, and news media. How to prepare for a wildfire threat at home. Kreese gave three overarching tips for residents interested in personal fire preparation. Be ready, set a plan, and evacuate when threats exist. Number one, be ready means keep your grass mowed short, your trees and brush trimmed, and consider defensible space zones in your landscape plans. Number two, setting a plan should involve escape routes, including two ways to get out of your neighborhood, city, and region. Set a safety meeting location with your family, he said. Number three, stay informed and evacuate if you feel threatened. Monitor news and social media during an emergency to know if and when to act. And that article is entitled, How Phoenix is Preparing for a Catastrophic Wildfire, and that was by Taylor Seeley. We're approximately 31 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 9th, 2025. Continuing on with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled, What to Know About Arizona's Severe Flu Season. This is by Stephanie Innes. Are you in the throes of a fever and body aches? Or were you flattened by the flu and now have a cough that won't go away? You are not alone. The U.S., including Arizona, is in the midst of a nasty wave of influenza, the first high-severity U.S. season in 7 years, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In Arizona, individuals ages 18 to 49 comprise the highest percentage of cases, state surveillance says. State data shows cases likely have peaked and are trending downward, but the virus is still circulating at high levels and above the seasonal average. In other words, don't let your guard down. National and state flu surveillance and reports from providers indicate that both the influenza A and B viruses continue to linger in homes, schools, workplaces, and public spaces. This season is definitely more severe than average, and we're actually seeing higher than usual hospitalizations and a greater number of patients needing medical interventions than years prior, said Dr. Jeremy Driscoll, an emergency room physician with Scottsdale-based Honor Health. We're seeing a lot more prolonged fevers and higher rates of respiratory complications, specifically pneumonia. Anyone who ventures out, whether it's to the gym, the grocery store, work, or school, should assume that the flu virus is there, Driscoll said. Here are answers to some common questions about the flu. What are symptoms of the flu and how is it treated? People who have flu often feel some or all of these signs and symptoms, the CDC and other public officials say. They are fever or feeling feverish with chills, though not everyone with the flu will have a fever, cough, often a dry cough, sore throat, runny or stuffy nose, muscle or body aches, headaches, fatigue or tiredness. Some people may have vomiting and diarrhea, though this is more common in children than adults. Most people who get the flu don't get sick enough to go to the hospital and can treat themselves at home with rest, hydration, and over-the-counter medications such as acetaminophen for fever and a cough suppressant if needed. How long am I contagious with the flu? There's no answer to this that applies to everyone, but generally, the CDC guidance says that one may be contagious for 1 day before the onset of symptoms, and that contagiousness can last for at least 5 to 7 days after getting sick. The CDC says people with flu are most contagious during the first 3 days of their illness. There aren't 100% perfect guidelines, Driscoll said. It's hard to say cut and dried this many number of days because it's very person-dependent sometimes. But the CDC's recommendations are 5 to 7 days after symptoms start, and that's based on the most scientific data that's available. But elderly people, children, and people with weakened immune systems may spread it to others for longer than a week, sometimes up to 2 weeks, Driscoll said. The theory is that their immune systems aren't as robust, so it takes longer for their body to mount the type of immune response needed to eradicate the virus, he said. According to the CDC, most experts believe that flu virus is spread mainly by tiny droplets made when people with flu cough, sneeze, or talk. These droplets can land in the mouths or noses of people who are nearby. Less often, a person might get flu by touching a surface or object that has flu virus on it, and then touching their own mouth, nose, or possibly their eyes, the CDC says. Should I wear a mask if I've had the flu? For how long? Wearing a mask during the tail end of one's illness can help protect coworkers, classmates, and other vulnerable individuals from exposure, especially if you are working in close contact environments such as transportation or schools, Driscoll said. Wearing a mask is a responsible way, in my opinion, to reduce transmission, especially if you're still coughing and sneezing and otherwise feel well enough to go back to work or school, Driscoll said. Especially because we know it's spread through droplets from coughing, sneezing, talking. You may not know that the person you are working with has a medical condition or is on medications that compromise their immune system, Driscoll said. You're not necessarily thinking that that person could get way more sick than you would if you're otherwise young and healthy, he said. The big thing is those shared spaces, healthcare settings, office spaces, childcare facilities, or direct customer-facing jobs. Isn't flu season almost over? Case numbers are going down, but flu and RSV activity remain high in Arizona. The number of Arizona flu cases for the week ending February 22nd was up nearly 150% over that same week during a typical flu season. Cases were up 31% over the same time last year, the data shows. And that article was entitled, What to Know About Arizona's Severe Flu Season, and that was by Stephanie Innes. Now, in some political news, this article is entitled, Mark Kelly Addresses Concern Raised During VP Bid. The subtitle is, Once Wary of Pro-Union Bill, He's Now Co-Sponsor. This is by Ronald J. Hansen. Senator Mark Kelly is co-sponsoring a union-friendly bill likely to languish in the Republican-controlled Congress, but it could help recast one of the more stinging criticisms of him when he was in the running for the vice presidential nomination last year. The latest version of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act, is slightly different than prior efforts to strengthen unionization protections. Unlike the one considered in 2024, Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, is officially on board from the outset, as is nearly every Democrat in the Senate, including Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, who has long cultivated close ties to unions. I grew up in a union household, and it was my mom getting a good union job that really changed things for our family, Kelly said in a written statement announcing his support. But now that's harder for working people, in large part because too much money and power is concentrated in the hands of a few rich people and corporations. Right now, President Trump wants to sign another tax giveaway for those same people while he's going after the rights of workers to organize. I'm backing the PRO Act to support American workers and to make sure families get ahead. It comes as Kelly has raised his national profile as a prominent early critic of the second Trump administration. Kelly criticized and voted against two of President Donald Trump's more controversial nominations, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence. He decried what he cast as indiscriminate cuts to the federal workforce amid the rapid downsizing overseen by billionaire Elon Musk and Trump's Department of Government Efficiency. and Kelly has made at least four appearances on the National Sunday Public Affairs TV shows already this year. Kelly's view of the proposed measure briefly got extra scrutiny when he was a finalist for then-Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate last summer. Labor unions still have an outsized pull within Democratic politics, and the PRO Act has stood as perhaps the biggest item on their legislative wish list. Kelly had previously expressed reservations about at least one provision of the bill, but never signaled his outright opposition to it. While he was in consideration for the VP nomination, Kelly said he would support the bill, but there was at least some wariness about him in organized labor. At the time, John Samuelson, president of the Transport Workers Union, told ABC News it was unimaginable the Democrats would consider Kelly, citing the PRO Act as a top concern. Why would the Democrats even consider a senator for the vice presidency if the senator doesn't support the PRO Act? It's the most important piece of national legislation workers have right now, he said then. Kelly has held owner or investor stakes in several businesses and has been a self-reliant entrepreneur for years. He was a registered Republican when he lived in Texas during his NASA career. Kelly had mixed support from unions in his two prior Senate runs. Kelly supported raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour in early 2021 when he knew he would be back on the ballot in 2022. The issue came up as part of a COVID-19 relief package in the early days of the Biden administration. In 2022, for example, Fred Yamashita, then the executive director of the AFL-CIO in Arizona, praised Kelly as a worker-friendly candidate. Months earlier, Yamashita also pointed to news accounts of Kelly joining then-Senators Kyrsten Sinema, who was an Arizona Democrat at the time, and Joe Manchin, who was then a West Virginia Democrat, in sinking the nomination of a former Obama labor appointee to head the Labor Department's wage and hour division under President Joe Biden. On Wednesday, Yamashita, who is now Secretary Treasurer of the union, was among the labor voices welcoming Kelly's support for the PRO Act. This has been an ongoing relationship. He's been very supportive of labor overall, Yamashita said Wednesday. He's had more of an opportunity to really look deeper into it and understand that ultimately this is the best thing for workers being able to organize to protect themselves in the workplace. Jason Sangster, business manager for the Iron Workers Local 75, said the organization stands with Kelly because he knows firsthand the difference a union job can have on a family. And that article is entitled, Mark Kelly Addresses Concern Raised During VP Bid, and that was by Ronald J. Hansen. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today, with two front page articles, one on government funding and the second is on Greenland. The first is entitled GOP Bill to Avert Shutdown Unveiled, with the subtitle Plan Provides Funds Through September. This is by Bo Erickson. Republicans in control of the U.S. House unveiled their six-month stopgap government funding bill on Saturday to avoid a potential government shutdown on March 14th. The proposal would fund the government through September, the end of the 2025 fiscal year, and mostly maintain levels of spending passed during the last administration. The House is expected to vote on the 99-page funding bill on Tuesday, Republican leadership staff told reporters on Saturday. The aide said the funding package, called a continuing resolution because it would maintain funding approved from last year, has been closely coordinated with the White House. President Donald Trump has also signaled his support as this could clear the way for Republicans in control of both chambers of Congress to focus on extending the 2017 tax cuts implemented by Trump in his first term. All Republicans should vote please yes next week, Trump posted on social media on Saturday. Great things are coming for America, and I am asking you all to give us a few months to get us through to September so we can continue to put the country's financial house in order. The president's support for this stopgap funding plan has encouraged some hardline Republicans who have previously voted against similar stopgap funding bills, a crucial hurdle in the chamber where House Speaker Mike Johnson leads a slim 218-214 Republican majority. The recently proposed cuts from Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency are not included in this latest stopgap funding bill. Johnson has said those cuts can be addressed in next year's government spending negotiations. Nonetheless, Republican and Democratic appropriation negotiators had been trying to come together in recent weeks to pass the required 12 government spending bills for the 2025 fiscal year. But the Trump administration's cuts to the federal workforce and ongoing threats to withhold congressionally appropriated spending have stymied agreements. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries on Friday said his Democratic caucus could not support a partisan funding plan by Republicans. "I strongly oppose this full-year continuing resolution, which is a power grab for the White House and further allows unchecked billionaire Elon Musk and President Trump to steal from the American people," Representative Rosa DeLauro, the top Democratic House appropriator, said in a statement after the funding bill was released. "By essentially closing the book on negotiations for full-year funding bills that help the middle class and protect our national security, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have handed their power to an unelected billionaire." House Republicans, however, insist the funding bill is a clean continuing resolution because it contains no supplemental funding. The stopgap funding bill also only applies to discretionary spending and not mandatory spending for Social Security retirement payments and the Medicare and Medicaid government health care programs. The Republicans' proposed bill increases defense spending by about $6 billion, while decreasing non-defense spending by about $13 billion, the House Republican leadership aide said, adding they are confident the total government spending across federal departments is below levels approved in the last fiscal year. Some of the proposed increase to defense spending includes an already authorized pay bump for lower-level military personnel and funding for building submarines. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have been pushing for higher levels of defense spending than the current level authorized during former President Joe Biden's term. The Republican leadership staffer said the House funding proposal includes a request from the Trump administration for additional funding for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which carries out deportations, because the agency is operating at a shortfall. A $20 billion rescission for the Internal Revenue Service is also carried forward in this funding proposal, as was the case in the stopgap government funding plan that was passed in December. No congressionally directed spending for lawmaker-requested projects was included in this bill. That was entitled GOP Bill to Avert Shutdown Unveiled, and that was by Bo Erickson. Our second front page article from USA Today is entitled "Inuit Pride Stirs Independence Mood in Greenland," with the subtitle "General Election Set as Trump Renews Interest." This is by Jacob Granholt Peterson. In a tiny workshop in Greenland's capital, Nuuk, goldsmith Nadia Arnarak Kreutzmann polishes metals and stones mined and gathered on the vast mineral-rich island. The jewelry she crafts is adorned with Inuit symbols of life and survival. Indigenous identity is seeing a revival in Greenland ahead of a general election on Tuesday, called after U.S. President Donald Trump said he wanted to acquire the strategically located Arctic island. Trump's interest has shaken the status quo, and combined with a growing Inuit pride, has led some locals to view the vote as a historic chance to free Greenland from Danish influence. Greenland, which has a population of only 57,000 people spread across an area around three times the size of Texas, is an autonomous territory within the Kingdom of Denmark and can choose full independence through a referendum process. All the main parties support independence, but they differ on how and when it could be achieved, given Greenland's reliance on Denmark for half its annual budget. Factions seeking a faster track have been galvanized over the past month by fresh accusations of historical wrongdoings in the exploitation of mineral wealth. In the 1950s, Danish authorities initiated a forced relocation of Inuit to larger towns, marginalizing the practices and languages of the indigenous people who make up almost 90% of the population. The Inuit cultural resurgence in Greenland has taken off in recent years as understanding about colonial repression spreads, with a new embrace of traditional face and body tattoos a visible example. For many years, it was embarrassing for a lot of people being Greenlandic, and they would suppress the Greenlandic culture and try to be more Danish in their appearance and their way of living, said Kreutzmann, age 43, whose European surname and Inuit line tattoos on her arms reflect her own mixed heritage. "We were told to act more Danish, to speak Danish, if we wanted to be something," she said in Nuuk, where wooden houses and primary colors contrast with snow that blankets the town and with white-blue icebergs in the bay. Now, speaking Greenlandic, looking Greenlandic, and all of Greenland's cultural heritage are being celebrated, said Kreutzmann, whose work includes a pair of earrings shaped like scales of the capelin fish, a small but vital part of the Arctic ecosystem and Inuit diet. Since 1979, Greenland has had its own prime minister and other institutions, but strategic decisions such as foreign affairs, monetary policy, and defense remain under Danish control. The current parliament's four-year term ends in April. Election polls are scarce, and political analysts said it is not clear whether voters will again back the ruling left-wing-led coalition. Greenland's government, meanwhile, is wary of foreign interference in the election, banning overseas donations from the campaign in February in response to Trump's comments. For this story, Reuters spoke to more than a dozen Greenlanders, all of whom said they favored independence from Denmark and the United States. Most wanted Greenland to decide its own foreign affairs, but many warned against acting rashly in light of Trump's comments, fearing Greenland could become worse off and expose itself to the United States if it too quickly seeks independence from Copenhagen. Independence for Greenland could pave the way for more U.S. influence, already substantial on an island seen as vital for U.S. security interests, at a time when the Arctic region has increasingly come into the geopolitical spotlight as Russia and China intensify military activity there. Trump has cited China and Russia's Arctic presence among his reasons for his interest in Greenland, which the United States previously offered to buy for $100 million from Denmark in 1946 after World War II. A recent poll indicated that 85% of Greenlanders do not wish to become a part of the United States, with nearly half seeing Trump's interest as a threat. Kim Kleist Erickson, an artist who carves walrus tusk and bones into detailed sculptures inspired by traditional Greenlandic symbols and stories, said Trump's offer had brought positive attention, but that he was offended by his approach. "At first, I thought it was a joke, but he was serious. What kind of man tries to buy a country in 2025, said Erickson, age 40, whose work sells locally and abroad. "I was disgusted." Erickson aims to keep a Greenlandic art form alive, from a time when hunters used walrus tusks and bones to make hunting tools, amulets, or toys. "I get to do art out of the stories that I've heard as a child and put them into carving," Erickson said. "It gives me a deeper understanding of myself and my culture." The missionary. One person hoping to capitalize on Trump's interest is Kupanuk Olsen, social media influencer and mining engineer turned candidate for Nalarok, the leading pro-independence political party, currently the largest opposition force in Greenland's Inatsisartut parliament. Olsen, age 39, found her political calling after Trump's comments created an opportunity to intensify the conversation around independence, she said. Every Greenlander now needs to have an opinion, she said. We need to decide whether we should continue to stay under Denmark, whether we should become independent, or whether we should become a state under the United States. Olsen spoke to Reuters by Nuuk's colonial-era harbor, overlooking a wooden red Christian church and beneath a hilltop statue of Hans Egede, the missionary sent by the Danish king in the 18th century and who for many Greenlanders symbolizes the colonial era and loss of traditional Inuit values. I strongly believe the statue will be gone in the nearest future and replaced by a Greenlander who represents all of us, or an Inuit myth or something different that represents our culture and identity, said Olsen, who gave up Christianity to pursue Inuit religious practices. Her party believes that U.S. interest strengthens Greenland's position in secession talks with Denmark. The party aims to bring a deal with Copenhagen to a vote before the next election in 4 years. Three candidates told Reuters they wanted a defense agreement with the United States. Liv Aurora Jensen, a candidate for the ruling left-wing Inuit Ataqatigiit Party, was more cautious. We have to choose very wisely what to do because I think we still want to be a part of Denmark, working ourselves toward independence. But we also need to work with other countries, our neighbors, Canada and United States, Jensen said. United Airlines is due to begin direct flights from New York to Nuuk for the first time in June. Trump again mentioned Greenland on Tuesday, promising mutual prosperity and hitting a more conciliatory tone from previous comments that had refused to rule out military action to acquire the island. We strongly support your right to determine your own future, and if you choose, we welcome you into the United States of America, he said during a major speech to the U.S. Congress. And that is all the time that we have for this particular article entitled Inuit Pride Stirs Independence Mood in Greenland. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 9th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.